Constance was the victim of a jealous tyrant, whom she called her father. The cruel Genseric suspected that his son's wife had conspired to poison him. The supposed crime was punished by the amputation of her nose and ears, and the unhappy daughter of Theodoric was ignominiously returned to the court of Toulouse in that deformed and mutilated condition. This horrid act, which must seem incredible to a civilized age, drew tears from every spectator. But Theodoric was urged by the feelings of a parent and a king to revenge such irreparable injuries. The imperial ministers, who always cherished the discord of the barbarians, would have supplied the gods with arms and ships and treasures for the African war, and the cruelty of Genseric might have been fatal to himself if the artful Vandal had not armed in his cause the formidable power of the Huns. His rich gifts and pressing solicitations inflamed the ambition of Attila, and the designs of Aetius and Theodoric were prevented by the invasion of Gaul. The Franks, whose monarchy was still confined to the neighborhood of the Lower Rhine, had wisely established the right of hereditary succession in the noble family of the Merovingians. These princes were elevated on a buckler, the symbol of military command, and the royal fashion of long hair was the ensign of their birth and dignity. Their flaxen locks, which they combed and dressed with singular care, hung down in flowing ringlets on their back and shoulders, while the rest of the nation were obliged, either by law or custom, to shave the hinder part of their head, to comb their hair over the forehead, and to content themselves with the ornament of two small whiskers. The lofty stature of the Franks and their blue eyes denoted a Germanic origin. Their close apparel accurately expressed the figure of their limbs. A weighty sword was suspended from a broad belt. Their bodies were protected by a large shield, and these warlike barbarians were trained from their earliest youth to run, to leap, to swim, to dart the javelin or battle axe with unerring aim, to advance without hesitation against a superior enemy, and to maintain, either in life or death, the invincible reputation of their ancestors. Clodion, the first of their long-haired kings whose name and actions are mentioned in authentic history, held his residence at Dispagum, a village or fortress whose place may be assigned between Louvain and Brussels. From the report of his spies, the king of the Franks was informed that the defenseless state of the second Belgic must yield on the slightest attack to the valor of his subjects. He boldly penetrated through the thickets and morasses of the Carbonarian forest, occupied Tournai and Cambrai, the only cities which existed in the 5th century, and extended his conquests as far as the river Somme over a desolate country whose cultivation and populousness are the effects of more recent industry. While Clodion lay encamped in the plains of Artois and celebrated with vain and ostentatious security the marriage, perhaps, of his son, the nuptial feast was interrupted by the unexpected and unwelcome presence of Aetius, who had passed the Somme at the head of his light cavalry. The tables, which had been spread under the shelter of a hill along the banks of a pleasant stream, were rudely overturned. The Franks were oppressed before they could recover their arms or their ranks, and their unavailing valor was fatal only to themselves. The loaded wagons which had followed their march afforded a rich booty, and the virgin bride with her female attendants submitted to the new lovers who were imposed on them by the chance of war. This advance, which had been obtained by the skill and activity of Aetius, might reflect some disgrace on the military prudence of Clodion. But the king of the Franks soon regained his strength and reputation, and still maintained the possession of his Gallic kingdom from the Rhine to the Somme. Under his reign, and most probably from the enterprising spirit of his subjects, his three capitals, Mantes, Trier, and Cologne, experienced the effects of hostile cruelty and avarice. The distress of Cologne was prolonged by the perpetual dominion of the same barbarians who evacuated the ruins of Trier. And Trier, which in the space of 40 years had been 4 times besieged and pillaged, was disposed to lose the memory of her afflictions in the vain amusements of the circus. The death of Clodion, after a reign of 20 years, exposed his kingdom to the discord and ambition of his 2 sons. Merovius, the younger, was persuaded to implore the protection of Rome. He was received at the imperial court as the ally of Valentinian and the adopted son of the patrician Aetius, and dismissed to his native country with splendid gifts and the strongest assurances of friendship and support. During his absence, his elder brother had solicited with equal ardor the formidable aid of Attila, and the king of the Huns embraced an alliance which facilitated the passage of the Rhine and justified by a specious and honorable pretense the invasion of Gaul. Part 2. When Attila declared his resolution of supporting the cause of his allies, the Vandals and the Franks, at the same time, and almost in the spirit of romantic chivalry, the savage monarch professed himself the lover and the champion of the princess Honoria. The sister of Valentinian was educated in the palace of Ravenna, and as her marriage might be productive of some danger to the state, she was raised by the title of Augusta above the hopes of the most presumptuous subject. But the fair Honoria had no sooner attained the 16th year of her age than she detested the importunate greatness which must forever exclude her from the comforts of honorable love. In the midst of vain and unsatisfactory pomp, Honoria sighed, yielded to the impulse of nature, and threw herself into the arms of her chamberlain, Eugenius. Her guilt and shame, such is the absurd language of imperious man, was soon betrayed by the appearances of pregnancy. But the disgrace of the royal family was published to the world by the imprudence of the Empress Placidia, who dismissed her daughter after a strict and shameful confinement to a remote exile at Constantinople. The unhappy princess passed 12 or 14 years in the irksome society of the sisters of Theodosius and their chosen virgins, to whose crown Honoria could no longer aspire, and whose monastic assiduity of prayer, fasting, and vigils she reluctantly imitated. Her impatience of long and hopeless celibacy urged her to embrace a strange and desperate resolution. The name of Attila was familiar and formidable at Constantinople, and his frequent embassies entertained a perpetual intercourse between his camp and the imperial palace. In the pursuit of love, or rather of revenge, the daughter of Placidia sacrificed every duty and every prejudice, and offered to deliver her person into the arms of a barbarian of whose language she was ignorant, whose figure was scarcely human, and whose religion and manners she abhorred. By the ministry of a faithful eunuch, she transmitted to Attila a ring, the pledge of her affection, and earnestly conjured him to claim her as a lawful spouse to whom he had been secretly betrothed. These indecent advances were received, however, with coldness and disdain, and the king of the Huns continued to multiply the number of his wives till his love was awakened by the more forcible passions of ambition and avarice. The invasion of Gaul was preceded and justified by a formal demand of the princess Honoria, with a just and equal share of the imperial patrimony. His predecessors, the ancient Tanjou, had often addressed in the same hostile and peremptory manner the daughters of China, and the pretensions of Attila were not less offensive to the majesty of Rome. A firm but temperate refusal was communicated to his ambassadors. The right of female succession, though it might derive a specious argument from the recent examples of Placidia and Pulcheria, was strenuously denied, and the indissoluble engagements of Honoria were opposed to the claims of her Scythian lover. On the discovery of her connection with the king of the Huns, the guilty princess had been sent away as an object of horror from Constantinople to Italy, Her life was spared, but the ceremony of her marriage was performed with some obscure and nominal husband before she was immured in a perpetual prison to bewail those crimes and misfortunes which Honoria might have escaped had she not been born the daughter of an emperor. A native of Gaul and a contemporary, the learned and eloquent Sidonius, who was afterwards bishop of Clermont, had made a promise to one of his friends that he would compose a regular history of the War of Attila. If the modesty of Sidonius had not discouraged him from the prosecution of this interesting work, the historian would have related with the simplicity of truth those memorable events to which the poet, in vague and doubtful metaphors, has concisely alluded. The kings and nations of Germany and Scythia, from the Volga, perhaps, to the Danube, obeyed the warlike summons of Attila. From the royal village in the plains of Hungary, his standard moved towards the west, and after a march of 700 or 800 miles, he reached the conflux of the Rhine and the Neckar, where he was joined by the Franks, who adhered to his ally, the elder of the sons of Clodion. A troop of light barbarians who roamed in quest of plunder might choose the winter for the convenience of passing the river on the ice, but the innumerable cavalry of the Huns required such plenty of forage and provisions as could be procured only in a milder season. The Hercynian forest supplied materials for a bridge of boats, and the hostile myriads were poured with resistless violence into the Belgic provinces. The consternation of Gaul was universal, and the various fortunes of its cities have been adorned by tradition with martyrdoms and miracles. Troy was saved by the merits of St. Lupus. St. Servatius was removed from the world that he might not behold the ruin of Tongres, and the prayers of St. Genevieve diverted the march of Attila from the neighborhood of Paris. But as the greatest part of the Gallic cities were alike destitute of saints and soldiers, they were besieged and stormed by the Huns, who practiced in the example of Metz their customary maxims of war. They involved in a promiscuous massacre the priests who served at the altar and the infants who, in the hour of danger, had been providently baptized by the bishop. The flourishing city was delivered to the flames, and a solitary chapel of St. Stephen marked the place where it formerly stood. From the Rhine and the Moselle, Attila advanced into the heart of Gaul, crossed the Seine at Auxerre, and after a long and laborious march, fixed his camp under the walls of Orléans. He was desirous of securing his conquests by the possession of an advantageous post, which commanded the passage of the Loire, and he depended on the secret invitation of Sangiban, king of the Alani, who had promised to betray the city and to revolt from the service of the empire. But this treacherous conspiracy was detected and disappointed. Orléans had been strengthened with recent fortifications, and the assaults of the Huns were vigorously repelled by the faithful valor of the soldiers or citizens who defended the place. The pastoral diligence of Anianus, a bishop of primitive sanctity and consummate prudence, exhausted every art of religious policy to support their courage till the arrival of the expected succors. After an obstinate siege, the walls were shaken by the battering rams. The Huns had already occupied the suburbs, and the people, who were incapable of bearing arms, lay prostrate in prayer. Anianus, who anxiously counted the days and hours, dispatched a trusty messenger to observe, from the rampart, the face of the distant country. He returned twice without any intelligence that could inspire hope or comfort. But in his third report, he mentioned a small cloud which he had faintly descried in the extremity of the horizon. "It is the aid of God," exclaimed the bishop, in a tone of pious confidence, and the whole multitude repeated after him, "It is the aid of God." The remote object on which every eye was fixed became each moment larger and more distinct. The Roman and Gothic banners were gradually perceived, and a favorable wind blowing aside the dust discovered in deep array the impatient squadrons of Aetius and Theodoric, who pressed forwards to the relief of Orléans. The facility with which Attila had penetrated into the heart of Gaul may be ascribed to his insidious policy, as well as to the terror of his arms. His public declarations were skillfully mitigated by his private assurances. He alternately soothed and threatened the Romans and the Goths, and the courts of Ravenna and Toulouse, mutually suspicious of each other's intentions, beheld with supine indifference the approach of their common enemy. Aetius was the sole guardian of the public safety, but his wisest measures were embarrassed by faction which, since the death of Placidia, infested the imperial palace. The youth of Italy trembled at the sound of the trumpet, and the barbarians who, from fear or affection, were inclined to the cause of Attila, awaited with doubtful and venal faith the event of the war. The patrician passed the Alps at the head of some troops whose strength and numbers scarcely deserved the name of an army, but on his arrival at Arles, or Lyon, he was confounded by the intelligence that the Visigoths, refusing to embrace the defense of Gaul, had determined to expect within their own territories the formidable invader whom they professed to despise. The senator of Vetus, who after the honorable exercise of the Praetorian Prefecture had retired to his estate in Auvergne, was persuaded to accept the important embassy which he executed with ability and success. He represented to Theodoric that an ambitious conqueror who aspired to the dominion of the earth could be resisted only by the firm and unanimous alliance of the powers whom he labored to oppress. The lively eloquence of Avitus inflamed the Gothic warriors by the description of the injuries which their ancestors had suffered from the Huns, whose implacable fury still pursued them from the Danube to the foot of the Pyrenees. He strenuously urged that it was the duty of every Christian to save, from sacrilegious violation, the churches of God and the relics of the saints, that it was the interest of every barbarian who had acquired a settlement in Gaul to defend the fields and vineyards which were cultivated for his use against the desolation of the Scythian shepherds. Theodoric yielded to the evidence of truth, adopted the measure at once the most prudent and the most honorable, and declared that as the faithful ally of Aetius and the Romans, he was ready to expose his life and kingdom for the common safety of Gaul. The Visigoths, who at that time were in the mature vigor of their fame and power, obeyed with alacrity the signal of war, prepared their arms and horses, and assembled under the standard of their aged king, who was resolved with his two eldest sons, Torismond and Theodoric, to command in person his numerous and valiant people. The example of the Goths determined several tribes or nations that seemed to fluctuate between the Huns and the Romans. The indefatigable diligence of the patrician gradually collected the troops of Gaul and Germany, who had formerly acknowledged themselves the subjects or soldiers of the Republic, but who now claimed the rewards of voluntary service and the rank of independent allies. The Lyti, the Armoricans, the Briones, the Saxons, the Burgundians, the Sarmatians or Alani, the Ripuarians, and the Franks, who followed Merovius as their lawful prince. Such was the various army which, under the conduct of Aetius and Theodoric, advanced by rapid marches to relieve Orléans and to give battle to the innumerable host of Attila. On their approach, the king of the Huns immediately raised the siege and sounded a retreat to recall the foremost of his troops from the pillage of a city which they had already entered. The valor of Attila was always guided by his prudence, and as he foresaw the fatal consequences of a defeat in the heart of Gaul, he repassed the Seine and expected the enemy in the plains of Châlons, whose smooth and level surface was adapted to the operations of his Scythian cavalry. But in this tumultuary retreat, the vanguard of the Romans and their allies continually pressed and sometimes engaged the troops whom Attila had posted in the rear. The hostile columns in the darkness of the night and the perplexity of the roads might encounter each other without design, and the bloody conflict of the Franks and the Gepidae, in which 15,000 barbarians were slain, was a prelude to a more general and decisive action. The Catalonian fields spread themselves round Chalon and extend, according to the vague measurement of Jonandes, to the length of 150 and the breadth of 100 miles over the whole province, which is entitled to the appellation of a champagne country. This spacious plain was distinguished, however, by some inequalities of ground, and the importance of a height which commanded the camp of Attila was understood and disputed by the two generals. The young and valiant Torismond first occupied the summit. The Goths rushed with irresistible weight on the Huns, who labored to ascend from the opposite side, and the possession of this advantageous post inspired both the troops and their leaders with a fair assurance of victory. The anxiety of Attila prompted him to consult his priests and haruspices. It was reported that after scrutinizing the entrails of victims and scraping their bones, they revealed in mysterious language his own defeat with the death of his principal adversary, and that the barbarians, by accepting the equivalent, expressed his involuntary esteem for the superior merit of Aetius. But the unusual despondency which seemed to prevail among the Huns engaged Attila to use the expedient, so familiar to the generals of antiquity, of animating his troops by military oration, and his language was that of a king who had often fought and conquered at their head. He pressed them to consider their past glory, their actual danger, and their future hopes. The same fortune which opened the deserts and morasses of Scythia to their unarmed valor, which had laid so many warlike nations prostrate at their feet, had reserved the joys of this memorable field for the consummation of their victories. The cautious steps of their enemies, their strict alliance, and their advantageous posts, he artfully represented as the effects not of prudence, but of fear. The Visigoths alone were the strength and nerves of the opposite army, and the Huns might securely trample on the degenerate Romans, whose close and compact order betrayed their apprehensions, and who were equally incapable of supporting the dangers or the fatigues of a day of battle. The doctrine of predestination, so favorable to martial virtue, was carefully inculcated by the king of the Huns, who assured his subjects that the warriors protected by heaven were safe and invulnerable amidst the darts of the enemy, but that the unerring fates would strike their victims in the bosom of inglorious peace. "I myself," continued Attila, "will throw the first javelin, and the wretch who refuses to imitate the example of his sovereign is devoted to inevitable death." The spirit of the barbarians was rekindled by the presence, the voice, and the example of their intrepid leader, and Attila, yielding to their impatience, immediately formed his order of battle. At the head of his brave and faithful Huns, he occupied in person the center of the line. The nations subject to his empire, the Rugians, the Heruli, the Thuringians, the Franks, the Burgundians, were extended on either hand over the ample space of the Catalonian fields. The right wing was commanded by Arderic, king of the Gepidae, and the three valiant brothers who reigned over the Ostrogoths were posted on the left to oppose the kindred tribes of the Visigoths. The disposition of the allies was regulated by a different principle. Sangiban, the faithless king of the Alani, was placed in the center, where his motions might be strictly watched, and that the treachery might be instantly punished. Aetius assumed the command of the left and Theodoric of the right wing, while Torismond still continued to occupy the heights which appear to have stretched on the flank and perhaps the rear of the Scythian army. The nations, from the Volga to the Atlantic, were assembled on the plain of Chalon. But many of these nations had been divided by faction, or conquest, or immigration, and the appearance of similar arms and ensigns which threatened each other presented the image of a civil war. The discipline and tactics of the Greeks and Romans form an interesting part of their national manners. The attentive study of the military operations of Xenophon, or Caesar, or Frederick, when they are described by the same genius which conceived and executed them, may tend to improve, if such improvement can be wished, the art of destroying the human species. But the Battle of Chalons can only excite our curiosity by the magnitude of the object, since it was decided by the blind impetuosity of barbarians, and has been related by partial writers whose civil or ecclesiastical profession secluded them from the knowledge of military affairs. Cassiodorus, however, had familiarly conversed with many Gothic warriors who served in that memorable engagement. A conflict, as they informed him, fierce, various, obstinate, and bloody, such as could not be paralleled either in the present or in past ages. The number of the slain amounted to 162,000, or, according to another account, 300,000 persons. And these incredible exaggerations suppose a real and effective loss sufficient to justify the historian's remark that whole generations may be swept away by the madness of kings in the space of a single hour. After the mutual and repeated discharge of missile weapons in which the archers of Scythia might signalize their superior dexterity, the cavalry and infantry of the two armies were furiously mingled in closer combat. The Huns, who fought under the eyes of their king, pierced through the feeble and doubtful centre of the allies, separated their wings from each other, and wheeling with a rapid effort to the left, directed their whole force against the Visigoths. As Theodoric rode along the ranks to animate his troops, he received a mortal stroke from the javelin of Andages, a noble Ostrogoth, and immediately fell from his horse. The wounded king was oppressed in the general disorder and trampled under the feet of his own cavalry. And this important death served to explain the ambiguous prophecy of the haruspices. Attila already exulted in the confidence of victory when the valiant Torismund descended from the hills and verified the remainder of the prediction. The Visigoths, who had been thrown into confusion by the flight or defection of the Alani, gradually restored their order of battle, and the Huns were undoubtedly vanquished since Attila was compelled to retreat. He had exposed his person with the rashness of a private soldier, but the intrepid troops of the centre had pushed forwards beyond the rest of the line. Their attack was faintly supported, their flanks were unguarded, and the conquerors of Scythia and Germany were saved by the approach of night from a total defeat. They retired within the circle of wagons that fortified their camp, and the dismounted squadrons prepared themselves for a defense to which neither their arms nor their temper were adapted. The event was doubtful, but Attila had secured a last and honorable resource. The saddles and rich furniture of the cavalry were collected by his order into a funeral pile, and the magnanimous barbarian had resolved, if his entrenchments should be forced, to rush headlong into the flames, and to deprive his enemies of the glory which they might have acquired by the death or captivity of Attila. But his enemies had passed the night in equal disorder and anxiety. The inconsiderate courage of Torismund was tempted to urge the pursuit, till he unexpectedly found himself with a few followers in the midst of the Scythian wagons. In the confusion of a nocturnal combat, he was thrown from his horse, and the Gothic prince must have perished like his father if his youthful strength and the intrepid zeal of his companions had not rescued him from this dangerous situation. In the same manner, but on the left of the line, Aetius himself separated from his allies, ignorant of their victory and anxious for their fate, encountered and escaped the hostile troops that were scattered over the plains of Chalons, and at length reached the camp of the Goths, which he could only fortify with a slight rampart of shields till the dawn of day. The imperial general was soon satisfied of the defeat of Attila, who still remained inactive within his entrenchments, and when he contemplated the bloody scene, he observed with secret satisfaction that the loss had principally fallen on the barbarians. The body of Theodoric, pierced with honorable wounds, was discovered under a heap of the slain. His subjects bewailed the death of their king and father, but their tears were mingled with songs and acclamations, and his funeral rites were performed in the face of a vanquished enemy. The Goths, clashing their arms, elevated on a buckler his eldest son Torismond, to whom they justly ascribed the glory of their success, and the new king accepted the obligation of revenge as a sacred portion of his paternal inheritance. Yet the Goths themselves were astonished by the fierce and undaunted aspect of their formidable antagonist, and their historian has compared Attila to a lion encompassed in his den, and threatening his hunters with redoubled fury. The kings and nations who might have deserted his standard in the hour of distress were made sensible that the displeasure of their monarch was the most imminent and inevitable danger. All his instruments of martial music incessantly sounded a loud and animating strain of defiance, and the foremost troops who advanced to the assault were checked or destroyed by showers of arrows from every side of the entrenchments. It was determined in a general council of war to besiege the king of the Huns in his camp, to intercept his provisions, and to reduce him to the alternative of a disgraceful treaty or an unequal combat. But the impatience of the barbarians soon disdained these cautious and dilatory measures, and the mature policy of Aetius was apprehensive that, after the extirpation of the Huns, the Republic would be oppressed by the pride and power of the Gothic nation. The patrician exerted the superior ascendant of authority and reason to calm the passions which the son of Theodoric considered as a duty, represented with seeming affection and real truth the dangers of absence and delay, and persuaded Torismond to disappoint by his speedy return the ambitious designs of his brothers, who might occupy the throne and treasures of Toulouse. After the departure of the Goths and the separation of the allied army, Attila was surprised at the vast silence that reigned over the plains of Chalons. The suspicion of some hostile stratagem detained him several days within the circle of his wagons, and his retreat beyond the Rhine confessed the last victory which was achieved in the name of the Western Empire. Merovius and his Franks, observing a prudent distance and magnifying the opinion of their strength by the numerous fires which they kindled every night, continued to follow the rear of the Huns till they reached the confines of Thuringia. The Thuringians served in the army of Attila. They traversed, both in their march and in their return, the territories of the Franks, and it was perhaps in this war that they exercised the cruelties which, about 80 years afterwards, were revenged by the son of Clovis. They massacred their hostages, as well as their captives. 200 young maidens were tortured with exquisite and unrelenting rage. Their bodies were torn asunder by wild horses, or their bones were crushed under the weight of rolling wagons, and their unburied limbs were abandoned on the public roads as a prey to dogs and vultures. Such were those savage ancestors whose imaginary virtues have sometimes excited the praise and envy of civilized ages. Part 3. Neither the spirit, nor the forces, nor the reputation of Attila were impaired by the failure of the Gallic expedition. In the ensuing spring he repeated his demand of the Princess Honoria and her patrimonial treasures. The demand was again rejected or eluded, and the indignant lover immediately took the field, passed the Alps, invaded Italy, and besieged Aquileia with an innumerable host of barbarians. Those barbarians were unschooled in the methods of conducting a regular siege, which even among the ancients required some knowledge, or at least some practice, of the mechanic arts. But the labor of many thousands, provincials and captives, whose lives were sacrificed without pity, might execute the most painful and dangerous work. The skill of the Roman artists might be corrupted to the destruction of their country. The walls of Aquileia were assaulted by a formidable train of battering rams, movable turrets, and engines that threw stones, darts, and fire. and the monarch of the Huns employed the forcible impulse of hope, fear, emulation, and interest to subvert the only barrier which delayed the conquest of Italy. Aquileia was at that period one of the richest, the most populous, and the strongest of the maritime cities of the Adriatic coast. The Gothic auxiliaries, who appeared to have served under their native princes, Alaric and Antala, communicated their intrepid spirit, and the citizens still remembered the glorious and successful resistance which their ancestors had opposed to a fierce, inexorable barbarian who disgraced the majesty of the Roman purple. 3 months were consumed without effect in the siege of Aquileia, till the want of provisions and the clamours of his army compelled Attila to relinquish the enterprise, and reluctantly to issue his orders that the troops should strike their tents the next morning and begin their retreat. But as he rode round the walls, pensive, angry, and disappointed, he observed a stork preparing to leave her nest in one of the towers and to fly with her infant family towards the country. He seized with the ready penetration of a statesman this trifling incident which chance had offered to superstition, and exclaimed in a loud and cheerful tone that such a domestic bird, so constantly attached to human society, would never have abandoned her ancient seats unless those towers had been devoted to impending ruin and solitude. The favourable omen inspired an assurance of victory. The siege was renewed and prosecuted with fresh vigour. A large breach was made in the part of the wall from whence the stork had taken her flight. The Huns mounted to the assault with irresistible fury, and the succeeding generation could scarcely discover the ruins of Aquileia. After this dreadful chastisement, Attila pursued his march, and as he passed, the cities of Altinum, Concordia, and Padua were reduced into heaps of stones and ashes. The inland towns, Vicenza, Verona, and Bergamo, were exposed to the rapacious cruelty of the Huns. Milan and Pavia submitted without resistance to the loss of their wealth, and applauded the unusual clemency which preserved from the flames the public as well as private buildings, and spared the lives of the captive multitude. The popular traditions of Comum, Turin, or Modena may justly be suspected, yet they concur with more authentic evidence to prove that Attila spread his ravages over the rich plains of modern Lombardy, which are divided by the Po and bounded by the Alps and Apennine. When he took possession of the royal palace of Milan, he was surprised and offended at the sight of a picture which represented the Caesars seated on their throne, and the princes of Scythia prostrate at their feet. The revenge which Attila inflicted on this monument of Roman vanity was harmless and ingenious. He commanded a painter to reverse the figures and the attitudes, and the emperors were delineated on the same canvas, approaching in a suppliant posture to empty their bags of tributary gold before the throne of the Scythian monarch. The spectators must have confessed the truth and propriety of the alteration, and were perhaps tempted to apply on this singular occasion the well-known fable of the dispute between the lion and the man. It is a saying worthy of the ferocious pride of Attila that the grass never grew on the spot where his horse had trod, yet the savage destroyer undesignedly laid the foundation of a republic which revived in the feudal state of Europe the art and spirit of commercial industry. The celebrated name of Venice, or Venetia, was formerly diffused over a large and fertile province of Italy, from the confines of Pannonia to the river Adua, and from the Po to the Rhaetian and Julian Alps. Before the eruption of the barbarians, 50 Venetian cities flourished in peace and prosperity. Aquileia was placed in the most conspicuous station, but the ancient dignity of Padua was supported by agriculture and manufactures, and the property of 500 citizens who were entitled to the equestrian rank must have amounted at the strictest computation to £1,700,000. Many families of Aquileia, Padua, and the adjacent towns who fled from the sword of the Huns found a safe, though obscure, refuge in the neighboring islands. At the extremity of the gulf, where the Adriatic feebly imitates the tides of the ocean, near 100 small islands are separated by shallow water from the continent, and protected from the waves by several long slips of land, which admit the entrance of vessels through some secret and narrow channels. Till the middle of the 5th century, these remote and sequestered spots remained without cultivation, with few inhabitants, and almost without a name. But the manners of the Venetian fugitives, their arts, and their government were gradually formed by their new situation, and one of the epistles of Cassiodorus, which describes their condition about 70 years afterwards, may be considered as the primitive monument of the Republic. The minister of Theodoric compares them, in his quaint declamatory style, to waterfowl, who had fixed their nests on the bosom of the waves. And though he allows that the Venetian provinces had formerly contained many noble families, he insinuates that they were now reduced, by misfortune, to the same level of humble poverty. Fish was the common and almost the universal food of every rank. Their only treasure consisted in the plenty of salt which they extracted from the sea, and the exchange of that commodity, so essential to human life, was substituted in the neighboring markets to the currency of gold and silver. A people whose habitations might be doubtfully assigned to the earth or water soon became alike familiar with the two elements, and the demands of avarice succeeded to those of necessity. The islanders, who from Graro to Chiozza were intimately connected with each other, penetrated into the heart of Italy by the secure, though laborious, navigation of the rivers and inland canals. Their vessels, which were continually increasing in size and number, visited all the harbors of the Gulf, and the marriage, which Venice annually celebrates with the Adriatic, was contracted in her early infancy. The epistles of Cassiodorus, the Praetorian prefect, is addressed to the maritime tribunes, and he exhorts them in a mild tone of authority to animate the zeal of their countrymen for the public service, which required their assistance to transport the magazines of wine and oil from the province of Istria to the royal city of Ravenna. The ambiguous office of these magistrates is explained by the tradition that in the 12 principal islands, 12 tribunes or judges were created by an annual and popular election. The existence of the Venetian Republic under the Gothic Kingdom of Italy is attested by the same authentic record which annihilates their lofty claim of original and perpetual independence. The Italians, who had long since renounced the exercise of arms, were surprised, after 40 years' peace, by the approach of a formidable barbarian whom they abhorred as the enemy of their religion as well as of their republic. Amidst the general consternation, Aetius alone was incapable of fear, but it was impossible that he should achieve, alone and unassisted, any military exploits worthy of his former renown. The barbarians who had defended Gaul refused to march to the relief of Italy, and the succors promised by the Eastern Emperor were distant and doubtful. Since Aetius, at the head of his domestic troops, still maintained the field and harassed or retarded the march of Attila, he never showed himself more truly great than at the time when his conduct was blamed by an ignorant and ungrateful people. If the mind of Valentinian had been susceptible of any generous sentiments, he would have chosen such a general for his example and his guide. But the timid grandson of Theodosius, instead of sharing the dangers, escaped from the sound of war, and his hasty retreat from Ravenna to Rome, from an impregnable fortress to an open capital, betrayed his secret intention of abandoning Italy as soon as the danger should approach his imperial person. This shameful abdication was suspended, however, by the spirit of doubt and delay which commonly adheres to pusillanimous councils, and sometimes corrects their pernicious tendency. The Western Emperor, with the Senate and people of Rome, embraced the more salutary resolution of deprecating by solemn and suppliant embassy the wrath of Attila. This important commission was accepted by Avienus, who, from his birth and riches, his consular dignity, the numerous train of his clients and his personal abilities, held the first rank in the Roman Senate. The specious and artful character of Avienus was admirably qualified to conduct a negotiation either of public or private interest. His colleague, Trigetius, had exercised the Praetorian Prefecture of Italy, and Leo, Bishop of Rome, consented to expose his life for the safety of his flock. The genius of Leo was exercised and displayed in the public misfortunes, and he has deserved the appellation of great by the successful zeal with which he labored to establish his opinions and his authority under the venerable names of orthodox faith and ecclesiastical discipline. The Roman ambassadors were introduced to the tent of Attila as he lay encamped at the place where the slow-winding Mincius is lost in the foaming waves of the lake Bonacus, and trampled with his Scythian cavalry the farms of Catullus and Virgil. The barbarian monarch listened with favorable and even respectful attention, and the deliverance of Italy was purchased by the immense ransom or dowry of the Princess Honoria. The state of his army might facilitate the treaty and hasten his retreat. Their martial spirit was relaxed by the wealth and indolence of a warm climate. The shepherds of the north, whose ordinary food consisted of milk and raw flesh, indulged themselves too freely in the use of bread, of wine, and of meat prepared and seasoned by the arts of cookery, and the progress of disease revenged in some measure the injuries of the Italians. When Attila declared his resolution of carrying his victorious arms to the gates of Rome, he was admonished by his friends, as well as by his enemies, that Alaric had not long survived the conquest of the Eternal City. His mind, superior to real danger, was assaulted by imaginary terrors, nor could he escape the influence of superstition, which had so often been subservient to his designs. The pressing eloquence of Leo, his majestic aspect and sacerdotal robes, excited the veneration of Attila for the spiritual father of the Christians. The apparition of the two apostles, Saint Peter and Saint Paul, who menaced the barbarian with instant death if he rejected the prayer of their successor, is one of the noblest legends of ecclesiastical tradition. The safety of Rome might deserve the interposition of celestial beings, and some indulgences due to a fable which has been represented by the pencil of Raphael and the chisel of Algardi. Before the king of the Huns evacuated Italy, he threatened to return more dreadful and more implacable if his bride, the Princess Honoria, were not delivered to his ambassadors within the term stipulated by the treaty. Yet in the meanwhile, Attila relieved his tender anxiety by adding a beautiful maid whose name was Ildico to the list of his innumerable wives. Their marriage was celebrated with barbaric pomp and festivity at his wooden palace beyond the Danube, and the monarch, oppressed with wine and sleep, retired at a late hour from the banquet to the nuptial bed. His attendants continued to respect his pleasures or his repose the greatest part of the ensuing day, till the unusual silence alarmed their fears and suspicions, and after attempting to awaken Attila by loud and repeated cries, they at length broke into the royal apartment. They found the trembling bride sitting by the bedside, hiding her face with her veil, and lamenting her own danger as well as the death of the king, who had expired during the night. An artery had suddenly burst, and as Attila lay in a supine posture, he was suffocated by a torrent of blood, which instead of finding a passage through the nostrils, regurgitated into the lungs and stomach. His body was solemnly exposed in the midst of the plain under a silken pavilion. Then the chosen squadrons of the Huns, wheeling round in measured evolutions, chanted a funeral song to the memory of a hero, glorious in his life, invincible in his death, the father of his people, the scourge of his enemies, and the terror of the world. According to their national custom, the barbarians cut off a part of their hair, gashed their faces with unseemly wounds, and bewailed their valiant leader as he deserved, not with the tears of women, but with the blood of warriors. The remains of Attila were enclosed within three coffins of gold, of silver, and of iron, and privately buried in the night. The spoils of nations were thrown into his grave. The captives who had opened the ground were inhumanly massacred, and the same Huns who had indulged such excessive grief feasted with dissolute and intemperate mirth about the recent sepulchre of their king. It was reported at Constantinople that on the fortunate night on which he expired, Marcian beheld in a dream the bow of Attila broken asunder. And the report may be allowed to prove how seldom the image of that formidable barbarian was absent from the mind of a Roman emperor. The revolution which subverted the empire of the Huns established the fame of Attila, whose genius alone had sustained the huge and disjointed fabric. After his death, the boldest chieftains aspired to the rank of kings. The most powerful kings refused to acknowledge a superior, and the numerous sons, whom so many various mothers bore to the deceased monarch, divided and disputed, like a private inheritance, the sovereign command of the nations of Germany and Scythia. The bold Arderic felt and represented the disgrace of this servile partition, and his subjects, the warlike Gepidae, with the Ostrogoths, under the conduct of three valiant brothers, encouraged their allies to vindicate the rights of freedom and royalty. In a bloody and decisive conflict on the banks of the river Nitad in Pannonia, the lance of the Gepidae, the sword of the Goths, the arrows of the Huns, the Suevic infantry, the light arms of the Heruli, and the heavy weapons of the Alani, encountered or supported each other, and the victory of Ardaric was accompanied with the slaughter of 30,000 of his enemies. Elak, the eldest son of Attila, lost his life and crown in the memorable Battle of Nitad. His early valor had raised him to the throne of the Akatsiris, a Scythian people whom he subdued, and his father, who loved the superior merit, would have envied the death of Elak. His brother, Dengisich, with an army of Huns, still formidable in their flight and ruin, maintained his ground above 15 years on the banks of the Danube. The palace of Attila, with the old country of Dacia, from the Carpathian hills to the Black Sea, became the seat of a new power, which was erected by Arderic, king of the Gepidae. The Pannonian conquests from Vienna to Sirmium were occupied by the Ostrogoths, and the settlements of the tribes who had so bravely asserted their native freedom were irregularly distributed according to the measure of their respective strength. Surrounded and oppressed by the multitude of his father's slaves, the kingdom of Dengisich was confined to the circle of his wagons. His desperate courage urged him to invade the Eastern Empire. He fell in battle, and his head ignominiously exposed in the hippodrome exhibited a grateful spectacle to the people of Constantinople. Attila had fondly or superstitiously believed that Inak, the youngest of his sons, was destined to perpetuate the glories of his race. The character of that prince, who attempted to moderate the rashness of his brother Dengisich, was more suitable to the declining condition of the Huns, and Inak, with his subject hordes, retired into the heart of the Lesser Scythia. They were soon overwhelmed by a torrent of new barbarians who followed the same road which their own ancestors had formerly discovered. The Geougen, or Avaris, whose residence is assigned by the Greek writers to the shores of the ocean, impelled the adjacent tribes, till at length the Iguas of the north, issuing from the cold Siberian regions, which produced the most valuable furs, spread themselves over the desert as far as the Borysthenes and the Caspian gates, and finally extinguished the empire of the Huns. Such an event might contribute to the safety of the Eastern Empire under the reign of a prince who conciliated the friendship without forfeiting the esteem of the barbarians. But the Emperor of the West, the feeble and dissolute Valentinian, who had reached his 35th year without attaining the age of reason or courage, abused this apparent security to undermine the foundations of his own throne by the murder of the patrician Aetius. From the instinct of a base and jealous mind, he hated the man who was universally celebrated as the terror of the barbarians and the support of the Republic. And his new favorite, the eunuch Heraclius, awakened the emperor from the supine lethargy which might be disguised during the life of Placidia by the excuse of filial piety. The fame of Aetius, his wealth and dignity, the numerous and martial train of barbarian followers, his powerful dependents who filled the civil offices of the state, and the hopes of his son, Gaudentius, who was already contracted to Eudoxia, the emperor's daughter, had raised him above the rank of a subject. The ambitious designs of which he was secretly accused excited the fears as well as the resentment of Valentinian. Aetius himself, supported by the consciousness of his merit, his services, and perhaps his innocence, seems to have maintained a haughty and indiscreet behavior. The patrician offended his sovereign by a hostile declaration. He aggravated the offense by compelling him to ratify, with a solemn oath, a treaty of reconciliation and alliance. He proclaimed his suspicions. He neglected his safety. And from a vain confidence that the enemy whom he despised was incapable even of a manly crime, he rashly ventured his person in the palace of Rome. Whilst he urged, perhaps with intemperate vehemence, the marriage of his son, Valentinian, drawing his sword, the first sword he had ever drawn, plunged it in the breast of a general who had saved his empire. His courtiers and eunuchs ambitiously struggled to imitate their master, and Aetius, pierced with 100 wounds, fell dead in the royal presence. Bethius, the praetorian prefect, was killed at the same moment, and before the event could be divulged, the principal friends of the patrician were summoned to the palace and separately murdered. The horrid deed, palliated by the specious names of justice and necessity, was immediately communicated by the emperor to his soldiers, his subjects, and his allies. The nations, who were strangers or enemies to Aetius, generously deplored the unworthy fate of a hero. The barbarians, who had been attached to his service, dissembled their grief and resentment, and the public contempt, which had been so long entertained for Valentinian, was at once converted into deep and universal abhorrence. Such sentiments seldom pervade the walls of a palace. Yet the emperor was confounded by the honest reply of a Roman whose approbation he had not disdained to solicit. "I am ignorant, sir, of your motives or provocations. I only know that you have acted like a man who cuts off his right hand with his left." The luxury of Rome seems to have attracted the long and frequent visits of Valentinian, who was consequently more despised at Rome than in any other part of his dominions. A republican spirit was insensibly revived in the Senate, as their authority and even their supplies became necessary for the support of his feeble government. The stately demeanor of an hereditary monarch offended their pride, and the pleasures of Valentinian were injurious to the peace and honor of noble families. The birth of the Empress Eudoxia was equal to his own, and her charms and tender affection deserved those testimonies of love which her inconstant husband dissipated in vague and unlawful amours. Petronius Maximus, a wealthy senator of the Anician family, who had been twice consul, was possessed of a chaste and beautiful wife. Her obstinate resistance served only to irritate the desires of Valentinian, and he resolved to accomplish them, either by stratagem or force. Deep gaming was one of the vices of the court. The emperor, who by chance or contrivance had gained from Maximus a considerable sum, uncourteously exacted his ring as a security for the debt, and sent it by a trusty messenger to his wife, with an order, in her husband's name, that she should immediately attend the Empress Eudoxia. The unsuspecting wife of Maximus was conveyed in her litter to the imperial palace. The emissaries of her impatient lover conducted her to a remote and silent bedchamber, and Valentinian violated, without remorse, the laws of hospitality. Her tears when she returned home, her deep affliction, and her bitter reproaches against a husband whom she considered as the accomplice of his own shame, excited Maximus to a just revenge. The desire of revenge was stimulated by ambition, and he might reasonably aspire by the free suffrage of the Roman Senate to the throne of a detested and despicable rival. Valentinian, who supposed that every human breast was devoid, like his own, of friendship and gratitude, had imprudently admitted among his guards several domestics and followers of Aetius. Two of these, of barbarian race, were persuaded to execute a sacred and honorable duty by punishing with death the assassin of their patron. And their intrepid courage did not long expect a favorable moment. Whilst Valentinian amused himself in the field of Mars with the spectacle of some military sports, they suddenly rushed upon him with drawn weapons, dispatched the guilty Heraclius, and stabbed the emperor to the heart, without the least opposition from his numerous train, who seemed to rejoice in the tyrant's death. Such was the fate of Valentinian III, the last Roman emperor of the family of Theodosius. He faithfully imitated the hereditary weakness of his cousin and his two uncles, without inheriting the gentleness, the purity, the innocence, which alleviate in their characters the want of spirit and ability. Valentinian was less excusable, since he had passions without virtues. Even his religion was questionable, and though he never deviated into the paths of heresy, he scandalized the pious Christians by his attachment to the profane arts of magic and divination. As early as the time of Cicero and Varro, it was the opinion of the Roman augurs that the 12 vultures which Romulus had seen represented the 12 centuries assigned for the fatal period of his city. This prophecy, disregarded perhaps in the season of health and prosperity, inspired the people with gloomy apprehensions when the 12th century, clouded with disgrace and misfortune, was almost elapsed. And even posterity must acknowledge with some surprise that the arbitrary interpretation of an accidental or fabulous circumstance has been seriously verified in the downfall of the Western Empire. But its fall was announced by a clearer omen than the flight of vultures. The Roman government appeared every day less formidable to its enemies, more odious and oppressive to its subjects. The taxes were multiplied with the public distress. Economy was neglected in proportion as it became necessary, and the injustice of the rich shifted the unequal burden from themselves to the people, whom they defrauded of the indulgences that might sometimes have alleviated their misery. The severe Inquisition, which confiscated their goods and tortured their persons, compelled the subjects of Valentinian to prefer the more simple tyranny of the barbarians, to fly to the woods and mountains, or to embrace the vile and abject condition of mercenary servants. They abjured and abhorred the name of Roman citizens, which had formerly excited the ambition of mankind. the Armorican provinces of Gaul, and the greatest part of Spain were thrown into a state of disorderly independence by the confederations of the Bagaudi, and the imperial ministers pursued with prescriptive laws and ineffectual arms the rebels whom they had made. If all the barbarian conquerors had been annihilated in the same hour, their total destruction would not have restored the empire of the West. And if Rome still survived, she survived the loss of freedom, of virtue, and of honor. Chapter 36. Sack of Rome by Genseric, king of the Vandals. His naval depredations. Succession of the last emperors of the West, Maximus, Avitus, Majorian, Severus, Anthemius, Olybrius, Glycerius, Nepos, Augustulus. Total extinction of the Western Empire. Reign of Odoacer, the first barbarian king of Italy. Part 1. The loss or desolation of the provinces from the ocean to the Alps impaired the glory and greatness of Rome. Her internal prosperity was irretrievably destroyed by the separation of Africa. The rapacious Vandals confiscated the patrimonial estates of the senators and intercepted the regular subsidies which relieved the poverty and encouraged the idleness of the plebeians. The distress of the Romans was soon aggravated by an unexpected attack, and the province, so long cultivated for their use by industrious and obedient subjects, was armed against them by an ambitious barbarian. The Vandals and Alani, who followed the successful standard of Genseric, had acquired a rich and fertile territory, which stretched along the coast above 90 days' journey from Tangier to Tripoli. But their narrow limits were pressed and confined on either side by the sandy desert and the Mediterranean. The discovery and conquest of the black nations that might dwell beneath the torrid zone could not tempt the rational ambition of Genseric. But he cast his eyes towards the sea. He resolved to create a naval power, and his bold resolution was executed with steady and active perseverance. The woods of Mount Atlas afforded an inexhaustible nursery of timber. His new subjects were skilled in the arts of navigation and shipbuilding. He animated his daring Vandals to embrace a mode of warfare which would render every maritime country accessible to their arms. The Moors and Africans were allured by the hopes of plunder, and after an interval of 6 centuries, the fleets that issued from the port of Carthage again claimed the empire of the Mediterranean. The success of the Vandals, the conquest of Sicily, the sack of Palermo, and the frequent descents on the coast of Lucania awakened and alarmed the mother of Valentinian and the sister of Theodosius. Alliances were formed, and armaments, expensive and ineffectual, were prepared for the destruction of the common enemy, who reserved his courage to encounter those dangers which his policy could not prevent or elude. The designs of the Roman government were repeatedly baffled by his artful delays, ambiguous promises, and apparent concessions, and the interposition of his formidable confederate, the king of the Huns, recalled the emperors from the conquest of Africa to the care of their domestic safety. The revolutions of the palace, which left the Western Empire without a defender and without a lawful prince, dispelled the apprehensions and stimulated the avarice of Genseric. He immediately equipped a numerous fleet of Vandals and Moors and cast anchor at the mouth of the Tiber, about 3 months after the death of Valentinian and the elevation of Maximus to the imperial throne. The private life of the senator Petronius Maximus was often alleged as a rare example of human felicity. His birth was noble and illustrious, since he descended from the Anician family. His dignity was supported by an adequate patrimony in land and money, and these advantages of fortune were accompanied with liberal arts and decent manners, which adorn or imitate the inestimable gifts of genius and virtue. The luxury